This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, how therapy can help the homeless.
I felt a weight lifted. And up until that time, it had felt like I had been carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders.
Getting to the root causes of homelessness. That story's on the way. Will Illinois take another step in the battle against smoking, raising the age to purchase tobacco products to 21? We'll have a report. Also, we hear about a group of women in Chicago who go out on the streets to help those caught up in human trafficking. And why some want to see Cahokia Mounds near St. Louis become a national monument. We'll also hear how a teacher encouraged her students to read with the help of a book turned into a movie. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Plenty ahead this hour, we'll learn about the 211 phone service and the information it provides. Also, amid a rise in vaping use among high schoolers, anti-smoking advocates want to raise the age to buy tobacco products in Illinois. We'll have a report. And we'll hear why some want to have Cahokia Mounds declared a national monument. All that and more this hour on Statewide. On a recent cold Friday night, 75 volunteers stood on multiple corners in Chicago's Roseland neighborhood. It was a show of support to end domestic sex trafficking in that area and to stand up for vulnerable black girls who are prostituted. Natalie Moore with public station WBEZ went out with the group, and she has this report.
Not for sale. And
the meetup spot was at 10 p.m. at Chicago Collegiate Charter School on 118th in Indiana. Inside, people warmed up with hot chocolate and sweets from the bakery Old Fashioned Donuts before trekking out, bundled up in the sub-zero weather. Tonight's organizer is community psychologist Kisha Roberts-Tabb. She's a Cook County human trafficking specialist and juvenile probation officer.
When black girls are exploited, they're usually called fast. They want it to. They're highly sexual. And so I want them to know that we're not looking at them like that. We're looking at them like victims because that's what they are. They're not fast girls. They're not loose girls.
Roberts-Tabb says these underaged girls are sold for sex. They are manipulated and likely know their pimps. Maybe it was someone they trusted. Or maybe they were lured by their traffickers via social media. Trafficking is connected to poverty, violence, gangs, and drugs.
All of that is going on in Roseland, and so if we know that these are pathways for our girls, we need somebody that's willing to stand up and say, not tonight, not for sale, not this girl. You know, we want to be a representation for the young ladies that feel like they are voiceless.
She says Roseland is on her radar because the majority of her cases come from this area, with girls as young as 12. But in 2017, there was only one police arrest for human trafficking.
What does that tell you about what's going on in the neighborhood?
We know, based on the law, that girls cannot be arrested for prostitution if they're under the age of 18. They're coming in for other crimes like robberies, and the majority of the girls are coming in for juvenile arrest warrants because they go missing.
She says it's hard to prove human trafficking because exploited girls sometimes don't see themselves as victims.
And they listen and then they really take action.
Volunteers, mostly women but some men and some teenage girls, assemble love bags to pass out to any girls they see on the street. Bags have toiletries, resource materials, and Bible scriptures. A group huddles to say a prayer over the bags.
Oh God, and we know, oh God, that because of you, oh God, you told us to go out into all the world, oh God, and to save them, oh God.
And then breakout groups form to gather on various South Michigan Avenue corners. I go with a group headed out to 119th Street. Smaller groups post on all four corners of the intersection. Group leader Anita Bonds Davis tells the volunteers they need to stay for a little while longer. Across the street, another volunteer gives a teenager a love bag.
If you all don't mind, we're going to stand out here until she gets on the bus because the lady just gave her a bag.
So I don't know whether or not.
How many buses just come? I'm just saying.
It's the Michigan bus got to come. The 119th bus went that way.
Okay.
And she's still standing here. So we're going to stand here until she.
3 minutes later, Bonds Davis comes back with info about the girl and the man standing next to her at the bus stop.
She's 16 years old. She just had a baby 3 days ago. Her mother's at work. And she said the guy's trying to talk to her. She really does not want to talk to him, but he's being persistent in talking to her, so we don't know if that's true or not.
She's got court for robbery soon. If she doesn't get on the bus, one of the women will take her home. Bonds Davis's 17-year-old daughter wants to go talk to her.
She want me to stand over there and talk to her?
Here comes the bus. We'll see. No, I don't want you over there talking to her.
I'm her age.
Bonds Davis doesn't want her to. Everyone is waiting to see if the 16-year-old will get on the bus. The scenario raises flags. She's young, alone, and a grown man is trying to talk to her. She's in the criminal justice system. All signs Kisha Roberts Tabb said earlier, but no one knows for sure the circumstances. Finally, the 119th Street bus comes. The girl gets on. The man doesn't. Another telltale sign. And a volunteer says she bets the girl and the man know each other and that they're waiting for the group of volunteers to disperse. She sees the girl take out her phone on the bus and text someone. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
Illinois lawmakers are considering whether or not to legalize sports gambling. They're still negotiating the details, but as Daisy Contreras reports, a recent analysis shows the state could benefit from allowing the practice sooner than later.
A legal market where the state regulates and taxes sports betting could bring close to $12 billion in wagers. That's according to a report by the Illinois Economic Policy Institute and the Project for Middle Class Renewal at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Robert Bruno, a professor at UIUC, says 10 states have already legalized sports gambling in the last year, but none are in the Midwest.
There's some advantage to be the first mover, so Illinois may want to be out of the box first. Obviously, that incentivizes taking action.
Bruno estimates up to $100 million annually in state tax revenue, which could go toward infrastructure or public education. Lawmakers have hinted that sports betting could help pay for a construction plan. I'm Daisy Contreras.
This is Statewide. Of course, you've heard of dialing 911, but what about 211? The service is available in most of the state, and it has a special function. It's a free service that connects callers with a broad range of government help, from housing to child care to job training and more. And this Monday, February 11th, is also National 211 Day to spotlight the service. John Kelker is president of the United Way of Central Illinois, and he joins us on Statewide to talk more about it. So, John, give us an idea, an overview of what the 211 service is all about.
Sure. 211 is a national program, a very simple three-digit phone number that people can call. It is a free service. And unlike 911 that we're so familiar with that reports an emergency or something of that nature, this is simply for health and human services as well as governmental information and referrals.
So give me an example of a typical call that might come in. What would somebody be asking about?
One of the top two calls that we get for all of Sangamon and Menard counties are for utility assistance or rent assistance. And what we find in a typical call, because you're calling and speaking to a trained operator, if you're having trouble as a family with utility bills, there's a good chance that there may be food issues in the home. There may be other issues in terms of, do we have next month's rent? We're finding that a single call can oftentimes lean into multiple referrals.
So this goes beyond just somebody saying, oh, here's a phone number to call or a contact information. This is somebody that's actually going to work with the caller.
Yes, to a couple of points. One, for utility assistance or rent assistance or food assistance, they actually geographically want to know where they are so that they can send them to the closest place if there's multiple resources. The other, if it's an emergency, not only are the operators trained to handle it, but they have the ability to make what's called a warm transfer. They can transfer someone to a suicide line while they're still talking to them and giving them the comfort they need. They can transfer them to a line handling domestic violence while they've got that person on the phone.
You mentioned Springfield specific, because that's where we're at talking about this, but it is available in much of the state of Illinois.
Yes, we're currently covering about 75% of the state. First communities to have it for us were the Quad Cities and Metro East, followed very quickly by Rockford and Springfield. It now, when I say 75%, that's geographically. We have a couple of spots in West Central and East Central Illinois, and we still have not figured it out in the city of Chicago.
Well, I guess some people might wonder, why is the United Way so involved in this specific service? And a lot of the things that we've just talked about are things that the United Way works to improve, and that is things like utility assistance, those types of issues. So I guess it does go hand in hand with what the United Way tries to do.
Yes, I think it does. United Ways across the country are the largest private funders of health and human services. So it seemed natural. How do we connect those people in need with the resources that they oftentimes we'll run into trouble trying to find?
So any place that this service is available, they just dial 211, they get connected. Some people might also say, well, what about the internet? That seems like an easy way to get information. Why is the phone service still a good approach for this type of way to connect people to what the information they need?
Right. And all the data that we have, the database for our 211 that's operated out of Bloomington and covers a lot of the state of Illinois, is available online, but it's not talking to a human being. Finding out where there may be food pantries in your community may not tell you the hours or the eligibility. And that's next follow-up that, again, if it's a food insecurity, what else might be there? What are some eligibility issues that you'd go through? And our trained operators know that so that you don't either get in your car or get a cab ride to a place that you're simply not eligible for.
We're talking with John Kelker. He's president of the United Way of Central Illinois, just ahead of National 211 Day. Of course, that is on February 11th. And we're talking about the 211 service, which provides an opportunity to connect people who need information on a broad range of services, getting those people that information. John, there's a cost that goes with it. How is this paid for?
The model that we use that covers most of the state of Illinois is done where I think there are now 23 different United Ways that all are collaboratively funding a program, an agency called PATH in Bloomington that has both professionals and a very robust volunteer platform, so that we don't have to have bricks and mortar in Bloomington, in Rockford, in Springfield, Champaign, Decatur. That cost model just wouldn't work. Technology allows all of those phone systems to direct it to that single office in Bloomington.
So let's say, you know, we've discussed here things like, you know, heating assistance or maybe somebody wanting more information about a government program. Those are, I would guess, in many cases, not necessarily emergency matters. But what if there was an emergency, like a natural disaster going on? What role does 211 play then?
211 in that case, very quickly, we don't need multiple calls relative to a hurricane. The community's been ravished. But at that point, now we need to know, where can I get clothing? Where can I take my animals? How do I connect back with family? 211 can do that, takes a tremendous burden off of the systems that are dealing with 911. And we have found, when you think of the hurricanes down in the Carolinas this past fall, 211 was at the rescue for those people, not first responders. We certainly respect the work that they do. But this is for families that now have to put their lives back together.
So how popular is the service as far as, maybe, I don't know if you have the number of calls necessarily, but, you know, you get good feedback on this.
We do. We are provided, every community that participates in the program gets reports on a quarterly basis on the number of calls, what services are the most needed in your community. We still get reports on what they weren't able to make a referral for. And that helps you build your community. Last year alone, we had just under 2,300 phone calls. That's for Sangamon County. And when you think that a single call might lead to 2, 3, or 4 referrals, that's about 1,000 opportunities that people didn't know about resources in their community.
So what is the future of the 211 service? Are there things you're wanting to add to it or do differently going forward? Or, you know, is it where you want it to be right now?
No, we always have to be changing. So I mentioned you can get that same information online. We're adding a chat feature, a text feature, but again, that doesn't give you the multiple referrals. But we are living in a society where text is oftentimes preferred over a phone call, talking to somebody. So we're excited to introduce it. We don't want it to carry the day as opposed to talking to a trained operator.
There might be people who are interested in this service but aren't sure of what they want to ask is of what 211 can actually help with. Is that okay if they call and just to see?
Sure it is, because it also lets our call center know. If you get one call that's a little out in left field, you simply let that person know that 211's not that right place. You get multiple calls like that, you can get back to those local communities and saying, we're getting asked about this. What services should have been available? So, yes, we would encourage people to call 211. You're making our system better, and the system can only be as strong as the database itself and the resources in each community.
Before I let you go, John, can you talk a little bit about how this was all put together, how this came to be?
Sure, I can. United Way Worldwide, along with the United Ways in Atlanta, Connecticut, and Texas, in 1998 petitioned for a single number like this. It was unanimously approved by the FCC, started in 2000. It took 10 years to get to Springfield and to the state of Illinois. Sometimes we know things go a little slow in our state office. But since 2010 in our state, again, now 75% is covered. And again, it is also, it's not replacing 911. It's a complement to that. It's not replacing 311 in some communities that have it. It's a complement to that. And one of the biggest things that I like, if you know a neighbor, a friend, a family member that needs assistance, there are 800 numbers, whether it's domestic violence or it's suicide or it's even food kitchens, but they're so hard to remember. 211 is an answer for every American, and we now have 211 in 47 states, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia.
John Kelker is president of the United Way of Central Illinois, and National 211 Day is coming up on February 11th. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, and thanks for promoting 211.
Learn more about the 211 phone service. A link is at our website at statewideshow.com. Still ahead, how trauma therapy is being used to help the homeless. This is Statewide. Still to come, trauma therapy for the homeless. We'll hear about a program in Illinois and how it's working. Supporters haven't given up on making Cahokia Mound State Historic Site part of the National Park System. They were disappointed 2 years ago when President Barack Obama left office without declaring the site a national monument. St. Louis Public Radio's Mary Leonard updates us on their new efforts and on other changes in the wind at the ancient mounds.
Bill Eisminger is standing at the base of the 100-foot-tall Monk's Mound, bracing himself against the icy winter wind. He's relating a story he's told countless times, how the ancient Mississippians built this massive earthen mound more than 1,000 years ago, one basketful of dirt at a time. Eisminger is assistant site manager at Cahokia Mounds. He's worked here for 48 years and figures he's climbed to the top of Monk's Mound at least 1,000 times.
Every time I get to the top, I always say it takes my breath away, both figuratively and literally. It is quite a bit of a climb, but once you get up there, it's just so impressive.
There's no getting away from modern life here. Cahokia Mounds is nestled between businesses, homes, and a vacant old discount store. A busy roadway runs right through the 2,200-acre site, where 72 ancient mounds are protected. But, Eisminger says, 156 steps into the sky, the intrusions just seem smaller.
You have a feeling of what ancient man saw and felt when they were up here.
Eisminger is 74 and plans to retire this year, which is big news to the site's volunteers and supporters. He's the public face of Cahokia Mounds. He coined the name America's First City to describe this hub of mounds where the ancients lived, worked, and worshipped atop earthen structures. The Mississippians built satellite mounds all across the region, stretching west across the Mississippi River. Kokia Mounds is a UN World Heritage Site, but Eismenger says he still meets people in the St. Louis region who don't understand its importance.
But I always tell people if we'd had a stone pyramid, people would know about us, but we got the earthen mounds, and for some reason that is not as, I guess, impressive to people as a stone structure would be.
Eismenger believes that might change if Kokia Mounds were part of the National Park Service. Supporters of the national park idea were disappointed 2 years ago when President Barack Obama left office without declaring the site, which is in his home state, a national monument. Ed Weilbacher of the Heartlands Conservancy led the effort, and he still gets emotional when he talks about it.
Well, 2 years ago, we were waiting for an announcement from the president, and we thought we were there.
Weilbacher says his nonprofit is now working with Illinois Congressman Mike Bost on new legislation to make Cahokia Mounds a National Historic Park. It would create a local, state, and federal partnership. The state would retain ownership of the site.
The national mood is not to have large expanses of land taken up, so we wouldn't be doing that in this case.
Weilbacher says national park status would also bring additional resources to Cahokia Mounds. State budget cuts 5 years ago forced the site to close on Mondays and Tuesdays. For now, the nonprofit Cahokia Mounds Museum Society is celebrating a smaller win, a $100,000 grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities to develop an educational app. It would allow visitors to point their smartphones or cameras at the ancient mounds and see virtual structures built by the Mississippians. The Society's Lori Belknap says the app will help people envision the site's magnificence.
And I think that will really do a lot to bring awareness to the site. We're hoping that it'll give people a whole new insight to what was really there.
Belknap likens the app to Pokemon Go and thinks it would be a big hit with visitors.
Mary Leonard with that report here on Statewide. Last year, our Dusty Rhodes spent an afternoon at a movie theater. She accompanied a group of students to view a popular teen drama based on a best-selling novel. The students had earned the right to be there, organized by one teacher with help from the Springfield community. And today we revisit that story.
I know what you're thinking. Using a movie to bribe kids into reading literature is one of the oldest tricks in the teacher playbook. But that's not exactly what was happening with this movie, this piece of literature, and this teacher.
My name is Catherine Jones, but I go by Cassie, and I teach high school English at Southeast.
Southeast is shorthand for Springfield Southeast High School. Among the three high schools in the Springfield District, Southeast has the highest percentage of African-American students.
Sometimes I feel like Southeast has the, I don't know if it's pressure or like celebration of being the black school. And I can't speak for other high schools because I really don't know very many people who go to those high schools or who teach at those high schools. But I know at Southeast, it's okay to be black.
Ms. Jones, who is white, graduated from Rochester High School in a small, prosperous suburb about 6 miles away. But look around her classroom, and it's clear she's made Southeast her home. Over the 8 years she's taught here, she's filled a wall of bookshelves with young adult novels and plastered every surface with snapshots of students holding up their favorite books. She prides herself on being able to match every reluctant reader with a book they'll love and then keep that fire lit. One way she does that is through a book club she started 7 years ago.
The very first year I did it with kids that were like struggling readers. Then we were reading this series of books, the Hazelwood High trilogy. We don't teach the third book, but we have copies of the third book. So I thought it was kind of just like the perfect time to start a book club. And I was like, well, come after school and we'll read the next one. And I'll have snacks and stuff. And then after that, it just kind of spun into its own little thing.
The students choose the book to read. The club went through a dystopian phase with the Hunger Games and Divergent series, and more recently explored LGBTQ issues with Dreadnought, We Are the Ants, and Beautiful Music for Ugly Children.
They also favor books that are being made into movies because they know I'm going to take them. Or we're going to watch it here. Like last week, we watched All the Boys I've Ever Loved, which is a Netflix movie, but we read the book. And then I had pizza and we watched the movie and that garnered some excitement.
Ms. Jones wasn't aware they had chosen another movie-bound book last year when they selected The Hate U Give. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for young adult fiction, and its subject matter was painfully relevant. The Hate U Give is told from the perspective of a 16-year-old black girl who sees her best friend killed by a white police officer. She then learns to speak out as the only witness to his death. Author Angie Thomas built in subplots like interracial dating, how to handle that friend whose jokes just happen to be racist, and what it means when a family leaves a traditionally black neighborhood to move to the suburbs. Still, the name of the book and the movie forms the acronym THUG. The phrase was popularized by the rapper Tupac Shakur.
You know, his thug life tattooed across his stomach. And he says that thug life is the hate you give little infants f**ks everyone. Meaning that if you treat a group of people badly since the time they were born, they're going to mess up society and there's going to be issues and you're going to pay for it later. And that's thug life.
Ms. Jones learned The Hate U Give had been made into a movie when Southeast alums started emailing her.
Old students just sent me the link and were like, have you seen the trailer? Because I'd like been pushing the book for so long. And they were really excited, and I was like, I got to do something with this.
She promised to take every Southeast student who read the book to see the movie in a theater.
The biggest problem that I encountered was just finding books. And so I just kind of like threw it up on Facebook, and people just started sending books to Southeast. And I don't know who sent them. They didn't even have like addresses attached. And I would say that we had at least 75 books donated, and every one of those copies was passed out to a kid.
One book went to Quadimian Perry. She told me she was reading it just for fun.
Reading's not a big part of my life. I don't like to read at all, but like I just have to just be really interested in something or I just won't read it.
She finished it just a few hours before boarding the bus to the theater. We'll get her reaction later in this story. Another book went to ninth grader Faith Bondon, who, like Quadamian, said she isn't usually interested in reading, but she sped through The Hate U Give in just 2 weeks. And part of what kept her going was the author's pitch-perfect use of teen slang, a talent rarely found in full-fledged adults.
I think she really did good. Like, if my parents were to try to do it, I'd be like, stop. But, like, for her, it's like, I don't know, it's like she's in our century, but just older. Like, she knew exactly where to use it and how to use it in the right time.
Faith and Quadamian are both black, but Ms. Jones says white students came asking for the book, too.
All different types of white kids. You got your white kids who hang around black kids, and they understand the culture, and they understand people. And then you've got your white kids who are a little more segregated, and they kind of just hang out with people that look like them. And those kids were asking for the book. That's what I kind of found astounding and really awesome. One of my favorite things that has happened so far is I have a white student. His science teacher emailed me and said, you got to give Sean a book. He keeps finishing early and he keeps just talking. You got to give him a book. So I put this on his desk and I said, you need to read this. He said, I'm not, there's no way I'm reading a 400-page book.
Well, that just meant I had to meet Sean. His last name is Skinnendore. He's 14. How fast did you read this book?
I would say about a week.
Is that faster than normal?
Yes. It usually takes me like 2 months to read a book.
He read the first 3 chapters to his girlfriend over the phone.
Actually, my mom was really surprised that I was reading, and I actually downloaded it on her Kindle for her to read it.
The book never mentions the Black Lives Matter movement, instead substituting a made-up group called Just Us for Justice. But Sean got the message.
I don't believe African-Americans get all the equality as we do, and it just kind of bothers me because a lot of my friends are African-American, and it could be them one day, you know?
Monday afternoon, 58 students rode a bus from Southeast High to a movie theater 12 miles across town. Every student on the bus had read the book, turned in a report, and paid $5 for a movie ticket. It started off with a scene that wasn't in the book. And for the next 2 hours, everybody in the small auditorium kept a mental tally of where the screenwriter deviated from the book. One addition the students seemed to enthusiastically endorse was a kiss. As the credits rolled, the Southeast kids gave the movie a few courtesy claps. The next day, I checked in with Quadimian.
It was some parts in the book that wasn't in the movie, and it was some characters in the book that didn't even exist in the movie.
But there were chunks of the movie she didn't see because she chose to go sit in the lobby.
The movie was kind of emotional because I was like sitting and thinking like, what if this stuff like will happen to my younger brother and stuff. So like that stuff kind of got to me, and like I wanted my little brother to be there to like see that type of stuff and see that it happens no matter what.
How old is your little brother?
My little brother is 16.
16 can be a dangerous age, especially for a tall child with dark skin. Damian gets that. She doesn't need her teacher to connect those dots for her. Ms. Jones just tries to provide a safe place for students to figure things out.
I'm not in the schools pressing my political views or anything like that. I am giving them the opportunity to go see a movie. It's an empowering movie. And it's an empowering movie for Black youth. I mean, the whole theme of the novel is to find your voice. Won't be quiet anymore. Unless they hear us loud and clear.
Damage can't be undone. Let's not pretend it did. Dusty Rhodes with that report. You can read more about it. The link's at our website, statewideshow.com. More than a quarter of people who are homeless also suffer from mental illness, and social workers and psychologists often connect that to traumatic experiences. One Springfield shelter is trying to address the problem with a trauma-informed support group. Mary Hansen has the story.
Keith Treadwell says it took a while for him to talk about the trauma he experienced.
I wouldn't say I was scared. I was uncomfortable and a little nervous.
The 46-year-old lives in Springfield and participates in Helping Hands' supportive housing program.
I went through their groups that they had. I took advantage of the help that they have there and got an apartment with a roommate. And life has been looking up ever since.
One offer of help is a weekly trauma-focused therapy group. Treadwell says he's struggled with a drug addiction and homelessness for years. He says at first he wasn't sure how the other men in the group would react to his story. But after he shared,
I felt a weight lifted. And up until that time, it had felt like I had been carrying the weight of the world on my shoulders.
The group aims to break the cycle of persistent homelessness, where men stay at the shelter, get help and find housing, only to end up back at the shelter months later.
Because of these cycles that happen, the cycle of addiction, the cycle of self-sabotage. Part of the reason that happens is because we're treating the branches and not the roots.
That's Megan Golden, the social worker with SIU Medicine who leads the group. The root cause, she says, is often trauma. That could be anything from an isolated incident, like losing your home in a natural disaster, or it could be events that played out over the course of several years, like child abuse. Golden says treating trauma is different from other therapeutic approaches that address anxiety or depression, because often the symptoms of trauma are different.
Flashbacks, nightmares, difficulty maintaining good relationships, hypervigilance where they're looking over their shoulder all the time. There's a lot of different ways I think trauma can affect people.
Usually about 10 shelter residents gather on Tuesday nights and sit in a circle. Golden will lead the discussion on relapse prevention, healthy relationships, or coping mechanisms. They've been meeting since April, and attendance is voluntary. But Kurt Everly, who's staying at Helping Hands, often convinces his friends or even newcomers to the shelter to come with him to the meetings. He says he tells them,
it might be useful if you have something on your mind. You know, you ain't got to say anything about your past or anything. You know, just something that you have can just talk about.
Everly says he's found others who share his struggles and even picked up a new coping mechanism.
Me and another guy, we color a lot. Try to define our issues so we don't get so mad and angry so quick.
Golden says sometimes it's easier to understand the link between trauma and unhealthy behaviors, like substance abuse, when people hear it from others in a similar situation. And that's the power of the group sessions.
You know, it's not enough for me to come in and sit in an office with them and try to help them see that. They hear it from a friend, and that friend shares a story that they connect with. And that friend's story about, you know, this was my life and this is how it's affected me, and I really want to, like, stop living in the past, or I really want to stop having this experience define me. They hear that from someone that they relate to, and that's really healing.
Golden says once the men leave the shelter and stop coming to the group sessions, she hopes they continue individual therapy, though she acknowledges there is a need for better access to mental health care services in Springfield. I'm Mary Hansen.
Just ahead on Statewide, more on efforts to raise the state's age to buy tobacco products. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear about efforts to raise the smoking and vaping age in Illinois. More on the Tobacco 21 plan. And Jonathan All has a report on efforts to bring broadband to more rural areas. Next up, a recent ACLU of Illinois analysis found law enforcement officers throughout the state are stopping Black and Latino drivers at higher rates than white drivers. Reporter Daisy Contreras spoke to the ACLU of Illinois staff attorney Rachel Murphy to learn more on how the issue could be addressed.
This is a statewide report, and we looked at 3 years worth of data, 2015 through 2017. And what we found were that Black and Latinx drivers were searched more often or asked to consent to searches more often than white drivers. But then when officers performed these consent searches, Black and Latinx drivers were actually found with contraband less often than white drivers.
What are the impacts on these minority communities when they are stopped much more frequently than white drivers?
Studies show that when somebody is pulled over for a traffic violation, they are able to tell the difference between when it was an actual stop for a traffic violation or if the officer is actually trying to investigate some other crime. And either way, traffic stops can be embarrassing or frightening. And then when you've actually been stopped, not for a traffic violation, but in order to find out if you're involved in some other crime, studies show that you're less likely to trust the police. And these kinds of investigatory stops happen to Black drivers more frequently, which means that Black drivers trust the police less and they're less likely to call the police for help when needed. And these are serious consequences when you think about police-community relations.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras. I'm joined by ACLU staff attorney Rachel Murphy, here to talk about a recent ACLU of Illinois report titled Racism in the Rearview Mirror that sheds some light on the racial disparities in traffic stops and searches across the state. Rachel, the report also mentions the importance of trying to understand what causes discriminatory practices. And one conclusion is that it isn't just caused by an individual officer with a bias. We also have to look at institutional practices or department's culture to address the bigger issue.
What we think is that the data is really valuable in terms of understanding what's going on and where these disparities are occurring. So law enforcement agencies can use this data as a tool to actually evaluate their practices and make improvements, and that could be a different solution in every community. So you know, in some places it might be a training issue, in other places it might be a policy issue or a culture issue. And so it's really that the law enforcement agencies need to be using this data as a tool and working with the community to find solutions that fit their needs.
What are some of the other recommendations in the report to make sure the issue of racial disparities in traffic stops is addressed long term?
Our first recommendation is that this data collection be made permanent. It's set to expire in July of this year, and it needs to be made permanent, just as several other states have done with similar data collection laws. The second recommendation is that Illinois should ban consent searches. Third, data on police dogs should be reported and reviewed each year. All law enforcement officers should wear body cameras. All law enforcement agencies should investigate and report outcomes of complaints, especially racial profiling complaints. And finally, all law enforcement agencies
should report this data to the Illinois Department of Transportation as they're required to do under the state law.
Any chance that any of these recommendations will be tackled in a form of legislation this year?
So the Illinois Traffic and Pedestrian Stop Statistical Study Act is the one that is set to be repealed in July 2019, and Illinois lawmakers need to make it permanent.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Murphy of the ACLU of Illinois talking about racial disparities in traffic stops across the state. Find out more on that at statewideshow.com. A new study from the U.S. Census Bureau shows rural counties have significantly less access to high-speed internet. That disparity even greater in rural areas with high rates of poverty. This creates a major problem for economic development efforts. And Jonathan All reports the solutions will have to come from several directions.
And they're all custom bacons today. Have several different machines, but that's probably the one that's used the most right there, that bacon slicer.
Janice Thomas is walking through a giant meat cooler at Swiss Meat and Sausage in the small unincorporated village of Swiss in central Missouri. Workers are cutting bacon for a special order. Swiss Meat and Sausage is celebrating its 50th year in business, and Thomas says it's been very successful. But they need to grow, and that means more business online from far-flung customers.
Well, I think that's the one area where we need to expand. I mean, if there's one place that has some room, that's what we're hoping to expand in the future, is with our online ordering.
But that's where the problem comes in. Swiss has minimal internet access. It's not high speed, and it's unreliable. Thomas says it's her biggest barrier.
When it goes down, we can't get the orders, so it relies on that 100%.
Thomas says they invested in a satellite internet backup, but it's expensive and not reliable. It's a common problem for businesses that are in rural areas or looking to locate there. The lack of broadband service and no single unified effort to resolve the problem makes economic development much more difficult for regions that need to attract jobs. The struggles go well beyond traditional rural economic sectors like agriculture. Brewer Science is a microchip manufacturer based in Rolla, Missouri. They looked to build a plant in the nearby small town of Vichy 5 years ago. Rob Chin is the company's network administrator. He says the lack of good internet access was a major issue.
It did force us to redesign how some of our manufacturing systems worked to tolerate internet outages. We also added a backup connection from a wireless ISP, which is just the bare minimum we need to continue production.
Chin says if it weren't for the local company owner being committed to locating in a rural area, the business decisions would have made them look elsewhere. Tim Arbeiter says the struggles those companies face are played out countless times in rural communities across the Plains and Midwest. He's the director of broadband development for the Missouri Department of Economic Development. Arbeiter says businesses looking to expand or locate in a rural area start with a simple question.
Do I have the basic infrastructure needed to help me be successful in my respective business? And basic infrastructure now includes broadband, now includes high-speed internet. It is the utility of today.
Arbeiter says the answer often isn't what businesses want to hear, and they look to places with better internet access. While rural broadband issues are known and increasingly well-documented, the solutions are not as clear. Marshall Stewart leads the University of Missouri Extension and has adopted rural broadband as a pet project. He says there's a historical example, the Rural Electrification Project during the New Deal.
When it did, then it began to allow people to do commerce better. It allowed them to move product from the farm to the city. And I think what's happening in today's terminology is another iteration of that. Broadband today is what rural electrification was nearly 100 years ago.
But Stewart says the big difference is that rural electrification was a federally funded program.
The idea that there's going to be a sweeping federal effort to just fund broadband internet for the country, that's probably not going to happen wholesale.
Instead, he says, the solutions will be a combination of improved technology that will make it easier and cheaper to get broadband to rural areas, as well as targeted state and federal grant programs. The USDA announced in December it's offering $600 million in grants and low-interest loans to help expand broadband in rural areas. But businesses will rely upon internet service providers, rural co-ops, and local governments to apply for and get that federal money. Jonathan All, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. For decades, public health advocates have pushed for limits on smoking. They've included warning labels on products to limiting where someone can light up, all of which have helped bring down smoking rates. But in Illinois, a push to raise the smoking age has repeatedly failed to become law. For this week's Illinois Issues, Sam Dunklaw takes a look at the chances it has this year.
Smoking and chewing tobacco used to be the norm. You might remember being asked a routine question at restaurants, smoking or non. But over time, health organizations, lawmakers, and even the military have been increasingly outspoken about the hazards of tobacco. Nowadays, anti-smoking commercials abound, like this one from the ad campaign The Real Cost.
Cigarettes are bullies. Don't let tobacco control you.
Illinois lawmakers put their collective foot down in 2007 when they passed a landmark ban on public smoking. It's been more than a decade since then, and public perception of smoking has gone from bad to worse, especially among young people. An average of 95% of high school-aged kids in Illinois say they've never touched cigarettes, according to the most recent Illinois Youth Survey. But while high schoolers are ashing traditional tobacco, e-cigarettes and vaping products are on the rise. That same youth survey says vaping rates in Illinois are up dramatically. You might not even realize that someone's vaping. One of the most popular products is Juul, spelled J-U-U-L. It can be easily concealed, since it's designed to look like a computer USB drive. Vaping involves nicotine derived from tobacco and can be highly addictive, like traditional cigarettes. All of this has led some state lawmakers and health lobbyists to double down.
We should do everything in our power to stop this devastating habit.
This is State Representative Camille Lilly, a Democrat from Chicago. She's one of the state house's leading anti-smoking voices. Last year, she was a sponsor of a plan supporters say would have taken tobacco, including vaping products, out of the hands of high schoolers once and for all by raising the purchasing age to 21. She and others partnered with the American Lung Association to try to get it done. The association's Kathy Dre says supporters have tried to up the smoking age 4 years in a row, but that effort has been snuffed out every time.
We do set the precedents here in Illinois. It's very important for the Midwest, for Illinois, to pass these laws. And we're just not there yet.
That's because Tobacco 21 hasn't had enough votes to pass. Last year, the idea made it to the governor's desk. Here's former Governor Bruce Rauner, who spoke with reporters right after he'd vetoed the measure last November.
I don't think that's going to change smoking among young people. And it would heavily hurt the economy, and it would push more people who choose to smoke to our border states.
Supporters failed to get enough backing to override it. But that hasn't stopped health advocates like Illinois Public Health Association Director Tom Hughes from keeping a steady drumbeat against youth smoking.
The tobacco industry has recognized the age at which a person starts smoking as a key indicator to their own success. The age restriction and the need for social distancing in order for them to never start smoking, that's part of the rationale for the bill.
On the other hand, tobacco businesses say it's not fair to restrict the freedoms and responsibilities an 18-year-old has. A common argument, if they're allowed to vote and serve in the military, why stop them from deciding whether to smoke or not? But some business owners, like Jason Smith of 618 Vape, agree with what Tobacco 21 is trying to do for kids. He's run vaping businesses in Carbondale and Anna for more than 5 years, and says he routinely turns teens away for trying to buy popular vape products for their underage friends.
My heart was to help people quit smoking, not sell the kids. It's wrong. I hate it. I wish it wouldn't happen that way. I didn't open my stores to do that.
Smith believes that raising the purchasing age alone won't do much of anything. He says more comprehensive ways of tackling the problem, like restricting where vape products can be sold, would be better still. Instead, he says shops like his are being scorned for being part of the problem when they could be part of the solution. Despite the objections, Tobacco 21 already has a lot of support. It has strong support among the majority Democratic Party, and some Republicans, like State Representative Tim Butler of Springfield, broke ranks to vote yes.
This is a vote that I'm making on my own personal beliefs. If we can take steps to make a healthier Illinois, I think we should do it.
The recent handoff of the governor's mansion to J.B. Pritzker could also give the measure the key support it's needed. So far, the new governor hasn't publicly signaled what side of Tobacco 21 he'd come down on. Meanwhile, more than 35 Illinois towns and counting have moved ahead on their own. They've bumped up the local smoking age to 21. Before the state of Illinois passed the indoor smoking ban more than a decade ago, towns were passing similar ordinances. When it comes to this year's Tobacco 21 proposal, supporters like Kathy Dre are more hopeful than ever.
There is still so much that we can do, and I hope that Tobacco 21 is our next tool in our toolbox.
I'm Sam Dunklaw.
That will do it for this week's Statewide. We're glad you could join us. If you missed any of this episode or past episodes, you can find them at statewideshow.com. Also, remember to like us on Facebook and subscribe to our weekly podcast at NPR One. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.